By exotic intuition, I knew that the occurrence of such interface colors in nature indicated the presence of tryptamine-related compounds. Going further, I knew that the Lepidopterous New World genus Morpholia, which is characterized by a large wing area usually entirely expressed in brilliant blue interphase coloration, would be an ideal group upon which to conduct research to illuminate this unstudied field. I knew that the enzymal process in insect metamorphosis received molecular tuning and control through resonation induced by the harmonic strum of forest insects that have neuroactive tryptamine in their bodies, acting for them as an antenna to the electron spin resonance signal of the collective DNA, just as it did for us in the experiment. This signal would, I thought, keep the entire class insecta keyed in to the point of maximum symmetry in the evolutionary stream, thus explaining the remarkable durability of the insect adaptation, which stabilized its basic evolutionary strategy some hundreds of millions of years ago. Such things I was told quite conversationally by the voice in my mind. During this time, the iridescent black sheen which resulted when Stropharia cubensis grew in clumps and larger mushrooms shed spores on the caps of smaller mushrooms particularly caught my eye. Interestingly enough, this same metallic blue-black sheen was very noticeably present on the carapace of a large and shrill beetle, a member of the genus Buprestidae that I captured in the forest in the heat of the afternoon. It is known that the chitinous material which forms the outer covering of insects and spores is one of the most electron-dense materials in organic nature, being, in this property, similar to metals. My inner teacher urged that this specimen be analyzed for the presence of psychoactive tryptamines. If they were found, it would tend to confirm that the species responsible for the buzz of the forest, the Coleoptera and the cicadas, will in some species be found to contain the tryptamine compound necessary to allow them to key in on harmine present in local Banisteriopsis lianas, and through them to the collective DNA network. I suppose that if a few of these species resonate, then other shrilling species could key themselves to the molecular signal, thus amplifying it and sustaining it through the forest for some hours of every day. Some of the life processes of the insecta, I felt sure, must be regulated through a few species in this way. These unlikely and bizarre ideas unfolded themselves over those long, hot days while Dennis lay confined to his hammock and I squatted on the earth nearby. By the third or fourth day, I had learned enough of the new and peculiarly symbolic language that he was speaking that I was more and more convinced that through it, I could observe him making a gradual but progressive integration. Often then, long silences would fall between the raves, and we would each drift off into a world of private reveries. Several times on such occasions, I looked down and noticed with a weird thrill that my unconscious fingers had been engaged in gathering small twigs and arranging them in patterns as though they were to be miniature fires. This unconscious laying of small fires by my busy fingers seemed to me most extraordinary. It was interpreted then as a literal overflowing of the organizing energies that were being poured into me from some unknown source, the same source that was supplying me with energy so that I could matter-of-factly eliminate the need for sleep. Occasionally, Dennis would interrupt me to ask that I or Ev smoke a cigarette for him. Questioning uncovered his belief that in hyperspace, the topology of all human bodies is continuous, and so he could just absorb what he needed directly out of our bodies. For 5 days, life went on in that mode, with us sending amazingly few waves of interaction out into the real world around us. The morning of the 10th of March changed that. I had hardly been away from the hut and the short stretch of trail that separated it from the edge of the pasture for 5 days. So after breakfast on that particularly flawless morning, I chatted with Dennis and found him calmer and more lucid than he had been since the experiment. So composed and relaxed did he seem that I made the inevitable mistake of taking the situation for granted. I slipped away with Ev and the butterfly net for a relaxed stroll down the trail and deeper into the jungle. We were gone scarcely 40 minutes, but returned to the hut and the clearing to find them humming with a deserted air of emptiness that was heart-sinking. I was not afraid that Dennis would wander into the forest and become lost, as I was convinced that whatever his state of mind, it did not include that sort of thing. What I did fear was that he might focus others' attention on us and the borderline areas that we were investigating. Leaving Ev at the camp, I ran to the pasture and across it to the mission on the far side. As I ran, I was busy telling myself that he would probably just have gone down to see Dave and Vanessa, and that I would, of course, find him there. I was too preoccupied to notice that the bells of the mission, silent normally except on Sundays, had been pealing for some time. As I came over the rise that gave me a clear view of the river house and the lake below the Choro, I saw Vanessa leading Dennis toward the river house. I could sense that the situation was more difficult than I had hoped. Vanessa was angry and had seized the situation to drive home her point. It seemed that Dennis must have bolted from his hammock the moment that Ev and I passed out of sight. He had gone straight to the mission, located the bell rope of the bell used to call the people to Mass, and had rung it furiously until the priest had found Vanessa and Dave, and they had none too gently persisted him to desist. Nevertheless, the already circulating rumor that one of our expedition had gone a bit off the deep end was not eroded by the sudden and totally public outrage. The delicate political balance I had established that had allowed me to have my way in the matter of treatment for Dennis was destroyed. Now Vanessa's idea that he should be moved to the river house was brought forth and endorsed by the priests and, I was told, by the police. Riding on the inner assurance that worry is preposterous, and seeing that I had completely lost control of the situation, I agreed to all suggestions. Vanessa had more news. An airplane was coming. It was not coming to take us out, but it would enable us to begin our withdrawal, since it would allow one of us to get a lift over 100 kilometers of jungle to San Rafael, where we had left the cache of equipment before making the overland march to La Chorrera. This was the only opportunity to fly rather than walk back to those supplies, and Vanessa pressed that we should take advantage of it. I agreed with everything. I assumed that soon the eruption of the millennium would obviate all such mundane concerns, but that was a fact that I would leave others to discover for themselves as they made their way into the ever-deepening dimension of the future. Dave had volunteered to go on the airplane. The decision was made almost at a moment's notice. He would reach our supplies and single-handedly undertake to have them and himself shipped up the Rio Putumayo and then back to Bogota. We would meet him back there when and if we got out by some means not yet clear. A bag was hastily packed. The airplane came skimming in, and then it was gone again, and we were four. Vanessa and Ev became Dennis's nurses. He was moved to the river house, and I preferred to continue to live at the jungle house to avoid crowding. Dave was gone. The debate continued as to whether the direction in Dennis' raving was toward improvement, or whether it was only progressive drifting in the world in which he had become lost. Dennis' move to the river was a turning point, and from then hence, the effects of the phenomenon unleashed were less in our minds and more in the world. Through it all, we were still after the lens-shaped object. What the teacher told me in the first few days after the experiment was, you almost got it. You didn't quite get it. Or rather, it used the metaphor of condensation. It is condensing. It was like a perfect alchemical metaphor. The stone is everywhere. It is here. Dennis would say, I can see it. It's 250 feet away, to the left, down near the water hole, hovering above the water. Each day it would get closer in. There were freak lightning storms. Slowly I noticed that meteorological phenomena tended to concentrate in the southeast. I began to look there, and whenever I did, I would see rainbows. Intuitions concerning what was going on ranged from the religiously profound to the utterly absurd. On the afternoon of the 12th of March, Dennis underwent a few hours when he was able to respond, however cryptically, to the questions we put to him concerning how things appeared to him. This all went on at the river house, and it happened that living around that house was a handsome rooster and his mate. He was perhaps the very cock that I had heard crow at dawn on the day of the experiment, and again 2 days thereafter. There was a perky alertness about this cock and hen that had received comment among us before. This particular afternoon, Dennis called our attention to the little hen, saying that if one thought of her as art, then the achievement she represented was immense. Who could make such a hen? Only the one who could have fashioned the peculiar world that we had fallen into. And that one is James Joyce. Over the next few minutes, he proceeded to make his case that Finnegan's Wake represented the most complete understanding of the relation of the human mind to the time and space around it, and that, therefore, Joyce, at his death, had somehow been shouldered with the responsibilities of overseeing this part of God's universe. In this, Dennis was only following Wyndham Lewis, who made Joyce's ascent to eminence in the afterworld the subject of his novel, The Human Age. Jim and Nora, as Dennis called the newly revealed deity and his consort, were in and through everything at La Chirera, particularly in the things that Joyce had loved. The little hen as the symbol of Anna Livia Plurabelle of the Wake was one of these things. It was Joycean humor that radiated outward from the path that he had followed. These ideas were absurd but delightful, and they led me eventually to reread Joyce and to accept him as one of the true pioneers in the mapping of hyperspace. They did not, however, shed much light on our predicament. From that view of life as literature, Dennis moved on. He reminded me that one of the alchemical analogues for the Philosopher's Stone that we shared in our private code of associations was a certain small silver key, a key to a box of inlaid wood with a secret compartment that had belonged to our maternal grandfather. I said that the ability to produce that key, which had been lost since our childhood, would prove the reality of Dennis' shamanic powers and their ability to materially transcend normal space and time. The conversation took the form of a question and answer session that ended with Dennis demanding that I hold out my hand, and then slapping his closed hand into my open one, letting out a loud, ludicrous squawk, and depositing in my palm a small silver key.
Then would you be convinced? Well,
look at this!
At the time, I was thunderstruck. We were hundreds of miles from anywhere. The key before me was indistinguishable from the key of my childhood memories. Had he saved that key over all those years to produce it now in the middle of the Amazon to completely distort my notion of reality? Or was this only a similar key that Dennis had been carrying when he arrived in South America, but that I had somehow not noticed until he produced it? This seemed unlikely. He was confined to a room far from our stored equipment, and it was difficult to conceive of him becoming calm and organized enough to go to the baggage and carefully sort through it to the secreted key. This matter of the silver key, whether it was the original key or where it had come from, has never been satisfactorily settled. The original box was lost long ago, so the key was never tested. A final ironic note is added to the story by the fact that both Dennis and I were fans of the stories of H.P. Lovecraft, and so were aware of his story, Through the Gates of the Silver Key, a tale seething with many dimensions, strange beings, and a cosmic time scale. After Dennis had moved to reside in the River House, there was no longer any need for my sleepless watch at night. But the lack of a need to sleep prevailed. I actually looked forward each day to the time when everyone would retire and I would have before me long hours of delicious silent thought. Like the fox spirit of the I Ching who wanders eternally among the jeweled night grasses, I wandered in the pastures and on the trails around La Chorrera. Sometimes I would sit beneath the Amma-initialed tree for hours, watching vast mandalas of space and time turn and glisten around me. At times I would walk, long strides, nearly loping, head thrown back, gazing at the every-colored stars. Effortlessly, the deeper something that shared my mind connected up the constellations for me and showed me the enormous zodiacal machine that must have come to the ancients with the same suggestive force. Understanding in the form of immersion in millions of images of mankind in all times and places, struggling with the insoluble enigma of being and human destiny. It was during those velvet, star-strewn jungle nights that I felt closest to understanding the tripartite mystery of the Philosopher's Stone, the UFO, and the human soul. There is something human that transcends the individual and that transcends life and death as well. It has will, motive, and enormous power. Under certain conditions, the manipulative power of consciousness moves beyond the body and into the world. The world then obeys the will of consciousness to the degree that the inertia of pre-existing physical laws can be overcome. This inertia is overcome by consciousness determining the outcome of the normally random microphysical events. Over time, the deflection of microphysical events from randomness is cumulative, so that eventually the effects of such deflections are to shift the course of events in larger physical systems as well. Therefore, the greater the amount of time consciousness has in which to make its effects felt, the greater the possibility becomes that the willed end will come to pass, as subtle pressure toward a given end accomplishes the series of micro-deviations eventuating in a non-random and anti-entropic situation, the secret, in short, of falling in love. Consciousness works the same way within the brain, but there matter and energy are in a more unbound and dynamic state than throughout the rest of nature. It is easy for consciousness to direct the electrical flow in the central nervous system, though we have no idea how this is done. It is less easy for it to move not electrons, but whole atomic systems spread far and wide in time and space. This may explain why it is easier to form a thought, but having one's wishes come true takes longer. There is an interphase between consciousness active in the world and consciousness active in the CNS and through the intermediary of the body. That interphase is language. In using language, consciousness informs the brain to inform the body, to impart to the random motion of the air molecules near but outside the body a coherency. This coherency is supplied by consciousness in the form of a word. None of the physical laws operating on the air molecules have been violated, because the coherent pattern of behavior of the molecules is due to an input of energy whose release was initiated by an act of conscious will. language is thereby seen to be a kind of parapsychological ability, since it involves action at a distance and telekinesis, albeit voice transduced. Perhaps under the influence of psilocybin, an immense energizing of will could be vocally transduced into the world and do more than imprint a signal onto the random motion of air molecules. Perhaps instead a sign, visibly beheld, might be transduced and appear through appropriate shifts of refraction in those same nearby air molecules. Normal speech itself is sometimes seen to affect the refractive index of the air in front of the speaker's mouth. Perhaps this is an indication of the hidden potential of speech to go beyond its normal function of symbolizing reality to actually signifying it. A more perfect logos would seem to be the result, a logos able to regulate the activity of the ego as it exists in the sum total of the individuals living at any time. It is like a god. It is the human god. It is something that will happen to human destiny sometime in the future, and because it will happen, it is happening. Nothing is unannounced, and the ontological mode of the higher dimensions into which humanity is being propelled is being anticipated by the singularity which we call the UFO. Vallée is correct. The UFO is teaching something through its reinforcement schedule. It is preparing us to confront the God facet of ourselves that our explorations into the nature of life and matter are about to reveal. Chapter 15, Saucer Full of Secrets. The 11th of March was the full moon. It passed uneventfully enough, meaning that I can now recollect little of what happened. I remained ecstatic, certain that all was for the best, certain that some definitive tipping of the hand by the thing we were dealing with was about to occur. The next day, in the late afternoon, Ev walked out to see me from the riverside house. She invited me to return with her to the river, for all of us to have dinner there together. She showed the strain of what we had all been going through. There was no doubt that whatever had happened to us, it was pushing all of us to the limits of what we could assimilate without wanting to resist it. As we walked back across the pasture, the atmosphere seemed to be even more alive and active with spawning clouds and drifting mist than usual. Ev pointed to the southeast where a black stratocumulus mass was seething and boiling up to great altitudes. We watched for a few moments and it became like a vast mushroom cloud, the aftermath of a thermonuclear blast. The impression was very startling, and Ev recalled to me Dennis' words with regard to the mushroom. He said that it was the mushroom at the end of history, that the shape of the atomic cloud was a pun in physics and biophysics on the transformative powers of the Stropheriad and its eruption into human history. As we watched, suddenly Ev gasped, for from the seeming base of the cloud had emerged what looked like a column of light. It was sustained and was not a bolt of lightning. It was hard to see how it could be a shaft of sunlight, since it was late afternoon, the sun in the west, and this was all taking place in the southeast. We watched it for perhaps a minute, and then it stopped abruptly. Ev was quite shaken. It was of an empirical order different than anything she had experienced at La Chorrera up to that time. Arriving at the riverside campfire, we learned that Vanessa had been up at the mission to the radio, to the bush pilot who had whisked Dave from our midst. The pilot was willing to follow Vanessa's intent and think of us as a low-grade emergency, and would return in a few days to fly us out. I was unhappy with these arrangements, but there was nothing that I could do, though I knew that we, the gringo strangers, would lose face with the local people when our need for this airlift became known. Also, I had not the faith of Vanessa that all Dennis needed to return him to normal was to check him into the world of modern psychiatry with its harebrained reductionism and chemotherapy. But there was nothing to be done for it, and so we dined in silence, each lost in thoughts unshared. The evening's only moment of humor was provided by Ev's animated description of Dennis evading Vanessa's wardenship and slipping away from the riverside house sometime during the previous night and going to sit quietly in the house of some Colombian colonistas who awoke to find him there as unassuming as a piece of furniture. The story died away, and the unspoken dimension of it all returned to move in the minds of each of us. The next day we would pack all our equipment and move it to the river in preparation for a flight that could come at any time and would certainly not come announced. Already we were preparing to withdraw from the vortex at La Chorrera. The next day was the 13th. The camp in the forest, the hallowed-seeming spot where the transforming experiment had occurred, was dismantled. All the artifacts that set it apart from dozens of other Witoto huts were tucked away, and it was returned to its folk anonymity. Outside in a pile, we left quite a cargo trove behind us, for the forced evacuation by airplane of the four of us plus the pilot left precious little room for any gear. Some insect and plant specimens would leave with us, the cameras, the notebooks on the experiment. That was to be it. The things that we left were quickly assimilated by the tolerant Witoto owners of the site of our attempt to probe hyperspace. We were all installed in the river house, ready to go with the airplane whenever it should appear. Everything seemed to be moving forward of its own accord. We swam in the river and sat on the rocks, scanning the sky and listening for the drone of the little amphibian. Thus the afternoon passed, with even Dennis quiet after an episode in the early morning in which he had methodically thrown the contents of his room out the window, to the point of ripping out the window frame and hurling it after everything else.